Excuse me, this is the conference coordinator. I would like to inform all participants this call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Ray, you may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everyone, to the Charm Telecon for February 2008. Today we have a terrific speaker and a terrific topic. 3 years ago, I think, let me do the math, yes, 2005 to 2008, 3 years ago, the Huygens probe landed and drifted down to the atmosphere of Titan and landed on the surface and returned some spectacular data sets. And one of the most intriguing was the descent imager and spectral radiometer. And today we have Dr. Marty Tomasko, who's joining us from Arizona, and he is the principal investigator on that instrument. And thank you very much, Marty, for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the descent imager spectral radiometer experiment, tell you a little bit about the instrument, tell you something about the data that we got, and kind of summarize where we are in analyzing and understanding the results that was obtained. If you all see the first slide, you see the name of this cumbersome instrument, descent imager spectral radiometer. We call it the DISR, or the DISR. And I'm Marty Tomasko, and we've had a very capable team, not only in Arizona, but in Europe as well. We have several German and French and Swiss investigators also as co-eyes on this experiment. Now, if we can go to the second slide. Let me see if I can advance mine down here. Yes, the second slide. It tells something about the capabilities of this instrument and what the instrument is. It's the one optical package on the Huygens probe that descended through the atmosphere of Titan. But it's not just a single camera. It's got many measuring capabilities. It's got a frame transfer CCD. This is the kind of detector that you can buy in digital cameras now. So commonly, often they talk about them as 5 megapixel or 7 megapixel or even 10 megapixel cameras. Ours is a 1/8 of a megapixel, but remember, we proposed in 1990 and were selected in 1991, and that's 17 years ago now, 18 years ago almost, and for those days, an 1/8 of a megapixel was about the state of the art. But this single CCD detector is fed by fiber optics that come from several different sets of four optics. And in particular, we have a visible spectrometer with fibers that look up and look down. We have a four-channel solar oriole camera in two colors, a short wavelength one we call blue, and a long wavelength one that's in the near-infrared we call red. And each of those cameras that looks up has linear polarizers, so they can measure the vertically polarized component and the horizontally vibrating component of the light they see. And then in addition, we have three frame imaging cameras that look down at different angles from straight down. One looks not quite straight down, almost straight down. One looks at intermediate angles, and one looks almost to the side. And so in that way, we can cover a range of angles from 6 degrees above the horizontal to within 10 degrees of straight down. And we also have a near-infrared spectrometer with two linear array detectors, 132 pixels long, and so we can get spectra of the near-infrared light out to 1.6 microns wavelength, looking up and looking down. And so the CCD and the infrared spectrometer cover the range from 0.48 microns to 1.6 microns, and then we also have an ultraviolet photometer that both looks up and looks down and gets us down to 350 nanometers. So we go from 350 to 480 with the ultraviolet, 480 to 960 with the visible, and 850 nanometers to 1600 nanometers for the near IR. So those are the channels in which we're sensitive. In addition to that, we carry a lamp, a small 20-watt lamp with a parabolic reflector, which we can use to illuminate the surface. And this is not so that we have enough light to take pictures, but it's so that we provide a continuous spectral range of illumination. So we illuminate all wavelengths in that range. And that way we can measure the reflectivity of the surface, not only through the atmospheric windows where sunlight makes it down to the ground, but also where no sunlight makes it down to the ground because we carry our own lamp. Finally, we have a sensor to detect the azimuth of the sun as the probe is expected to rotate. It has spin vanes on it, and the idea is it would fall down through the atmosphere. The spin vanes would make it rotate, and then we could get data at different azimuths relative to the azimuth of the sun. And the sun sensor was used to trigger those images. And finally, we have a hardware data compressor so that we can compress all this data and send it back to the orbiter and then eventually back to. So now if we can look at the next slide, the third slide here. This shows the placement of the instrument in the Huygens probe. The Huygens probe is about a meter, a little over 3 feet in diameter. And on one of the shelves, we have an electronics box and then a sensor head. And the sensor head sticks out through the wall of the probe and allows us a clear view up and down and left and right of the atmosphere through many different windows. And then the next slide shows the layout of the sensitive area of the CCD detector. And remember, this is a frame transfer detector. That is, half of the sensitive area of the detector is covered by an opaque foil, an opaque film, and it's only the top half that's in white that is sensitive to light, and it's fed by fiber optics. There's the down-looking imager on the left, the side-looking imager in the middle, and another down-looking imager on the right, and then in addition to that, there are strips, vertical strips, for the spectrometers looking up and down, and in the above right corner for the solar oriel camera and its four channels that also looks out. And so what happens is the sensitive area on top is converting light into electrical charge, and you can transfer the charge rapidly down underneath the opaque foil, and the time between transfers is the exposure time of whatever data you're collecting. So there are no moving parts, there are no mechanical shutters. It's all done with just electrically shifting the charge rapidly down underneath the foil and then slowly digitizing it and reading it out. So that's the way that half of the instrument that's fed by the CCD works. And the next slide shows a picture of this part of the instrument. You can see the fiber optic conduit, the metal envelope that covers the fiber optics. You can see the three lenses on the left side looking in three different directions, the one that looks most nearly down, the one that looks at intermediate angles, and the one that looks mostly to the side on the left side. On the right side, we have the CCD detector, and we have the fiber optics carrying the light back. You can also see this little cylindrical tube in the front that is a little grating spectrometer that divides the light up into all different wavelength bins, and we can measure the brightness in different wavelength bins with that spectrometer. And then in the front, on sort of toward the left and toward the top a little, you can see this device that's our solar oriel camera. It's really four separate lenses, two covered with a red filter, two covered with a blue filter, and each of the red ones and blue ones is covered with a sheet of polarizing material that's either vertically or horizontally oriented. So that's four cameras looking up and three looking to the side or down, that's seven, and then there's the spectrometer that looks up and down, that's nine. So we have essentially nine different instruments in this little device that's about 6 inches long. And the next slide shows how we plan to put the images together. This would be the footprint of images on the ground so that we can make a mosaic of the ground and get sort of the skydiver's eye view of the ground. We can look almost straight down and put 12 images around and fill that circle, and then we can look at the intermediate angles and put 12 around and fill that circle, and then finally the 12 around from the one that looks mostly to the side. In addition to those images, there's a little picture that almost looks like a ladder in three different regions, and those are the fields of view of our down-looking visible spectrometer. So we can measure spectra of different things in the scene, and we can try to correlate the spectral reflectivity of different parts of the terrain with the morphology, what the terrain looks like. So that's how the CCD cameras work. And the next slide shows the infrared spectrometer system. And again, there's a 6-inch ruler, and you can see the two linear array detectors are on the left side, and then there's this little grating spectrometer that measures the infrared spectrum of the light looking up and looking down. In the bottom of the right-hand end of the spectrometer, there's the one moving part in the whole Disser experiment package, and that's a small shutter that can open and close the entrance slit to let in light from the scene, or close it to measure just the dark current of the instrument, the thermally generated infrared current. We are careful to have that device spring-loaded so that it would always stay open if the electromagnet wasn't energized or failed for some reason, because it was only necessary to use that shutter in the early part of the descent when the camera was still fairly warm. Once we get into Titan's atmosphere more than 15 or 20 minutes, then we have a big copper thermal strap that connects the focal plane to the outside of the probe and cools it down enough so that the thermally generated dark current is not a problem. So we put a fair amount of thought into trying to minimize the number of moving parts to try to get as high a reliability as we could on the instrument. And then the next slide shows the basically all of the optical parts and built into the configuration in which they're going to be used. We had 1,000 machined parts in something about the size of a shoebox, and it was quite a packaging challenge to get this whole instrument in the small amount of space that we had available on the probe. So it looks kind of messy, but the next slide shows that when most of it is in the package, in the box, and you're just looking at the front end, the business end of the instrument here, and the front cover hasn't been placed on. And you see our little parabolic reflector, a gold-coated parabolic reflector with a little 20-watt lamp inside. And to the right of that, you see the three lenses for the camera that's looking down. Above that, you see the detector for the sun sensor that's going to tell when we've gone by the sun, and various other fibers that run around this whole system for the visible and the infrared spectrometers that look up and down in the solar oil camera. So it's pretty messy, but in this way we got just as much into the data stream as we possibly could. And then the next slide shows the whole thing, the whole sensor head all enclosed in the package. There's a little bit of black sponge rubber foam material on the right side of the instrument. That's the part that sticks out into the atmosphere. We didn't want to have a big heat leak and suck all of the heat out of the probe, so we insulated the front of the instrument just a little bit. You can also see the copper strap in about the middle of the box, this shiny copper-colored piece. That's eventually going to get bolted to another copper strap that goes out and attaches to the outside of the probe so that we can keep the focal plane nice and cold. The sensor head weighed 3.5 kilograms. The mass was 3.5 kilograms, out of which 1 kilogram was radiation shield around the detectors. We didn't want to have cosmic rays or energetic neutrons from the radioactive generators bombarding our detector and causing lots of noise in the system. So we used 1 kilogram of radiation shield in the device, and that turned out to be really very helpful and very necessary. Even with that 1 kilogram of radiation shield in the device, we could see the characteristics of the instrument begin to change from the moment the instrument was placed in the same room with the Cassini orbiter. It didn't start to degrade at launch, but it degraded a month earlier when the two were in the same room, and then we could watch the basically the dark current in our device gradually rise with time pretty linearly over the whole 7 years of the cruise. Even though the dark current rose with time, we could get the instrument so cold when we got to Titan that the dark current was really not a problem for us. Okay, so that gives you a little overview of the instrument. So it's more than just a camera. It's several cameras that look in different directions. It's two spectrometers that look both up and down. It's an ultraviolet photometer that looks up and down. And it's the sun sensor, and it's the hardware data compressor. So it's a fairly capable package in a few kilograms and not too many cubic inches of space. The next set of slides show several images of Titan taken by our instrument. There's an array of two across by three down images. And we could project these images in various different ways. But here we've done the, sort of the skydiver's eye view, and we have them projected as circles where the center is straight down, and as you go out through the circle, you're going more up toward the horizon. Often you want high magnification in an optical camera that you're going to use even on a planetary mission. The imaging science system cameras on the Cassini orbiter have very powerful telescopes in front of them. But we don't need high magnification. We don't want a small, tiny field of view with high magnification. We're actually there in the atmosphere, so we're pretty close to what we're looking at. We don't need more magnification. What we want is a wide field of view. We don't want to come down near something like the Grand Canyon and not happen to be looking over our shoulder towards where it is and miss the whole object. So the philosophy here is to build a camera that has the resolution of the human eye, or maybe a little more, or maybe a little less, but has this tremendous field of view so we can see everything that we're looking at, everything that's in the atmosphere. So the upper left-hand one is at high altitude. It's at about 150 kilometers altitude, and from that altitude, we're completely the surface is completely obscured by this photochemical haze in the atmosphere, and that's the haze that causes so much difficulty in seeing the ground clearly from orbit or from even from the Earth. But as we gradually fell closer and closer, we could see the ground start to become more clear through the haze. The upper right one is at an altitude of 20 kilometers and starts to show some bright and dark features. And actually, there's a little dark haze layer if you look right out toward the horizon. It's very thin, but you can see that haze layer there. We think that's probably some methane condensation at that altitude. And then the next two down show successively lower ones. The left one is 6 kilometers altitude. The right one is 2 kilometers altitude. And you can see how the scene changes as you get lower and lower. And then finally, the bottom two in this display are at even lower altitudes. Let's go to the next slide, which takes one of these and blows it up so you can actually see a little more clearly what we saw there. This is the one from 6 kilometers, and you see these this bright terrain on the upper left-hand part of the scene, but they're covered with these sort of dendritic drainage channels. And the fact that they're dendritic means we think they're caused by a horizontally distributed source, and we think most likely that's due to methane rain. We think methane rain cuts these channels with steep sides through the terrain, and then these little creeks and riverbeds run out towards this dark region in the center of the slide, which we think is a dark, dry lake bed that originally was filled with flowing methane, but the methane sinks into the ground or re-evaporates, and we think when we landed it wasn't there. The next slide shows a different kind of a projection of the scene. But again, you can see these drainage channels in the center, the top third and sort of center in this bright area, and you can see down into the lake bed. And in the lower right quadrant of this image, you can see evidence of fluid flow in the lake bed. You can see these little dark lines and streaks where the fluid was flowing and oozing along in the kind of the muddy lake bottom just before it evaporated or sank into the ground. So we'll have more to say about that, and I urge you to look at the movie if you have a chance after the talk is over to kind of download the movie and take a look at that and see what you think of the movie. Because we could see the terrain not only from one perspective, but the instrument drifted over the surface, we could actually see the ground from different perspectives. This next slide shows an image of the drainage channels on the right in a color-coded scheme where what we think the lowest material is kind of blue and the higher material gets more red. And then on the left side, we have an elevation terrain map that was constructed from the stereographic images looking in several different directions, several different perspectives of seeing the ground. And we can see that the highest terrain is about 150 to 200 meters high, and the lowest terrain here is about 20 meters below the reference level that was chosen for this display. And actually, it turns out that the drainage channels do run downhill, and they run towards the dry lake bed that's at the sort of the zero or minus 10 or 20 meters elevation, whereas the upland is 150 meters or so higher in altitude. So the production of these terrain maps is actually a key objective of the experiment, to not only see what the ground looks like, but actually be able to see what the elevations are of the terrain. Now, the next slide shows an image taken on the ground. We weren't sure the probe would survive landing, but it actually did. And I think one of the reasons is it landed in this soft, muddy lake bottom where the mud is not due to silicates, but probably due to ice chips, and where these rocks and boulders that you can see in this image on the left are rounded due to tumbling during fluid flows, periods when the fluid is flowing more rapidly. On the right side of this image, we have an Apollo image of the moon taken with the same perspective, or actually mapped into the same perspective, so you can get an idea of the size of the man on the horizon and the size of the footprint in the foreground, so you can get a feeling for the size of these cobbles or these rocks, ice rocks here. They're about 6 inches across. And then down in the bottom right-hand corner of the image, you can see the spot where our landing light was illuminating the ground very strongly when we got down to the surface. So I think the images were really very very interesting, very spectacular. We have images with resolutions of that ground image has some parts that are down at the millimeter scale, and we certainly have a good resolution at the centimeter scale. And so it gives us a view of the ground and a view of the surface of Titan that is just impossible from outside the atmosphere right now. Even with the radar imagery, we get down to a kilometer or a couple hundred meters, but we don't get a scene like that with the rocks and the cobbles. Actually, it looks remarkably Earth-like, I think. In fact, my backyard in Arizona, before we made any changes to it, looked just about like that image. So it's remarkably Earth-like, and the same kind of processes are happening on Titan as they're happening on the Earth. It's just that the fluid is not liquid water, it's liquid methane, and the surface is not silicates, but it's probably water ice frozen hard as a rock. The next slide shows a spectrum That is, we have reflectivity on the vertical scale and wavelength on the horizontal scale. And the black curve is the reflection spectrum of the surface of Titan that we measured using our landing light to completely illuminate the surface. We always thought, boy, if we could just land there, use our lamp, measure the reflection spectrum of the surface, we could just identify the composition of the surface just like that. It'd be just great. Well, now we've done it. We've gone there. We've illuminated the surface. We've measured the reflection spectrum. And would you believe now, 2.5-3 years after the encounter, we still haven't managed to duplicate that spectrum exactly in the laboratory. So we don't know what all the features, or actually the smooth shape of the spectrum, is due to, but we have some ideas. This depression at 1,500 nanometers to 1,600 nanometers can be due to water ice, but water ice would also produce some bumps in the two places indicated by the red arrows, and we need something to damp out those bumps. And here in this one, we've used methane, ethane, and propane ices, and then in the bottom, this red one is with some liquids. Unfortunately, we only have the liquid spectrum at the moment, longward of 1,400 nanometers, and there it looks like it's a pretty good match. But one of the things people are actively doing in the lab now is trying to get a spectra of liquid, methane, ethane, and propane at these slightly shorter wavelengths so that we can make additional comparisons with our reflection spectrum. But at the moment, we can say that it's a complicated mix of hydrocarbons. Probably there's water ice. We know that from a variety of pieces of evidence. But the exact composition and the exact mix is still to be determined from the measurement.
Hey, Marty, I had a quick question. The in the slide before, the pebbles that you see,
mm-hmm.
Do we know what those are made out of?
Well, the guess is they're made out of water ice. Mm-hmm. We think most of the crust is water ice. They're covering, probably those pebbles are coated with the aerosol that falls out of the atmosphere, and so they have this kind of orangey color that's typical of the aerosols. But we think that if you broke one of those open, it would be mostly water ice. It's just a covering on the outside of maybe some of the photochemically produced aerosols.
Okay, thanks. I think that's what I'd heard.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we saw the spectrum comparing the reflection spectrum of the ground with a couple candidate materials. One of the other objectives of our experiment was to be able to measure the meridional component of the wind. That is, the east-west component of the wind could be measured by the Doppler wind experiment to high accuracy, but the north-south component, they didn't have a very good component of motion in that direction, and so they had difficulty determining that. But as long as DISSER could see the ground, we could track our motion. And here we have the ground track with numbers along the ground track indicating the altitude in kilometers. And you can see from 13 kilometers down to about 8 kilometers, we drifted toward the east. And then we turned around and started to drift toward the west and slightly north. And then in the last kilometer, turned around again and started to drift toward the south and toward the east. So these ground tracks and the direction of the wind will provide some input for meteorology people and people who are building global circulation models about the extent of boundary layers and just how the winds move in the very low surface. Actually, we could see the ground from about 50 kilometers on down, and above 50 kilometers there is information from the long baseline, double long baseline interferometry using radio telescopes on the Earth to measure the transmissions from Huygens to measure the meridional component of the wind, and that data looks very interesting, and it seems to tie into our measurements at lower altitudes pretty smoothly. And we think after we're done, we're going to have three different sources of information: the Doppler wind experiment, which gives high-resolution winds toward the east and west, the double long baseline interferometry from the radio telescopes, which gives meridional motion, particularly at high altitudes, and then the DISR data that gives meridional and east-west motions at lower altitudes with high accuracy. So all of that's come together pretty well, I think. Now, in addition to learning about the surface, the nature of the surface, and the topography of the terrain, we also have as a major objective of this instrument to learn about the aerosols. What are these photochemical aerosols? How big are they? Where are they produced? Where do they go? What's their life cycle? How do they interact with the radiation field and the physics and the chemistry of the atmosphere? And in order to do that, we have the spectrometers and the solar oil camera and the polarization measurements. And the next slide shows the maximum degree of linear polarization as a function of altitude in our two colors of our solar oriole camera. And what you see is that at 130 kilometers altitude or so, where we started taking measurements, light was 60% linearly polarized. And that's not just singly scattered light, that's including whatever multiple scattering happened above us. To produce 60% polarization in light that's been scattered a few times means you have to be producing basically 100% polarization in every scattering. And it's different in the red and the blue because the optical depths are different. The haze thickness is basically different in the red and the blue. But that's consistent with both red and blue data sets, that you have to be able to produce essentially 100% polarization in a single scattering due to these aerosols. And the way it turns out is that in order to produce that high degree of polarization, the aerosols have to have some very tiny dimension. They can't be much bigger than about 0.05 microns or 0.06 microns in radius, so about a tenth of a micron across. If the aerosols are more than about a tenth of a micron across, you can't produce this high degree of polarization. So we need at least some dimension in the aerosols that's a tenth of a micron or less for producing this high degree of polarization. And the next slide shows what happens with our solar oriole camera. This is a camera that was intended and in fact measured the brightness of a vertical strip of the sky, a narrow strip that was maybe only 6 or 8 degrees wide, but 50 degrees long. It went from 20 degrees from the zenith to 70 degrees from the zenith. And as the probe rotated, we would get some of these images, or some of these maps of the brightness of the sky, quite close to the sun. And this shows a map within 10 or 20 degrees from the sun, and the outlines of constant brightness, these curved circular contours, are from a model with a particular size and shape for the aerosols, and the data that we measured is inside this red elongated roughly rectangular area. And actually, you have to look pretty hard, but if you look at the solid black contour, you can see a little difference between what's inside the red rectangle and what the contour looks like outside the red rectangle. So there's a small difference there, but actually all of the contours look like they're in very good agreement with the model. And this thing called the solar aureole is the brightness of light scattered in a fairly small distance away from the sun, and that high brightness is a measure of the projected area of the particle. And what we find is that in order to make good fits, we need something like 3,000 of these small chunks, each about a tenth of a micron across, 0.05 microns in radius. We need some 3,000 of them stuck together so that this particle is large enough to provide the scattering through small angles and yet has a small enough dimension to provide the high polarization. This was a major mystery some years ago, before Cassini was flown, and it was one of the drivers of our design of our instrument that we could actually understand how this all works. The next slide shows a kind of a picture of what an aerosol particle would look like if it had 2,000 of these little monomers stuck together in a loose arrangement where you could still see the small dimension to provide the high polarization. So this is a picture of one of those haze aerosols, if you like, with 2,000 monomers, and we think they're actually slightly larger. We think they have more like 3,000 monomers. I think what happens is the small individual clumps of solid material of a tenth micron across are produced in photochemical reactions at about 400 kilometers altitude, but then as they fall, they stick together. And first a pair of them stick together to make two, and then a clump of two would collide with another clump of two, and they would stick together to make four, and they would continue to grow by this binary aggregation into these loose, fluffy structures that include several thousand components. It only takes about 10 collisions to get up to 1,000 components, 1,000 monomers, and we have maybe 10 or 12 or 15 collisions that lead to these particles with several thousand little bitty pieces stuck together. So that's what we think the particles look like. And the reason we care about what the particles look like is we'd like to understand how radiation scatters and is transferred through the atmosphere. And if you have, if you know something about the size and shape of the particles, that's connected with their probability of scattering light in a single scattering through various angles. And the next slide shows a thing we call the phase function, the single scattering phase function, as a function of angle from 0 to 180 degrees. And so this is the relative probability of scattering a particle in a single scattering through 3 degrees or 5 degrees or 30 degrees or 180 degrees. And what you can see is they have very different forward peaks. And if you had a particle with 500 pieces in it, of these 0.05 micron pieces, it would have a lower forward peak. If you have 3,000, it has a higher forward peak. If it has 10,000, it has a still higher forward peak. And the height of that forward peak is important for understanding how light scatters in the atmosphere. So we think that the right one is the green one there with 3,000 monomers, and that tells us how the light scatters from a single scattering event. The next slide shows the data that we got with our spectrometers, our visible spectrometer in particular. And on the vertical scale is the brightness of a particular measurement in two colors, one at 529 nanometers toward the short end of our visible spectrometer, one at in the red at 830 nanometers in the near infrared, actually. And the horizontal scale is altitude. So as a function of altitude, this kind of double scattering diagram shows you what the data looks like. And when we first got the data back on the night of the descent, we had all kinds of plans for rapidly analyzing this data. But when we took a look at it, we just were pretty puzzled. This is not what we expected to get. This is not what we thought we would get. But the reason for it is that our sun sensor, which was supposed to make the instrument collect data at various specific angles from the sun, didn't work exactly as it was planned. The probe was not particularly stable. It had high-frequency, rapid, small oscillations, which interfered with the operation of our sun sensor from time to time. And so we got more nearly a random sampling of data at different angles from the sun. And this scatter in this data is not noise. The data has a 100-to-1 signal-to-noise ratio, so it's really high-quality data. But it's as the probe rotates. As the probe rotates, we're looking toward the sun, and we have the sun in our field of view, and it's very bright. And as we rotate 180 degrees away, we don't have the sun in our field of view, and it gets darker. And that's really what's going on. So before we could really understand how to understand this data or model this data, we had to figure out how the probe rotated. And in the next diagram, you can see how this data looks if you plot it as a function of azimuth angle from the sun. And as you look at 30 degrees from the sun and at 330 degrees from the sun, we have a field of view that includes the sun. And then if you look at 180 degrees from the sun, we don't include the sun anymore. And so all the data really goes together on this nice curve. We know where it is, this is an activity that took us 6 months to a year to figure out the attitude of the probe. But once we knew the attitude of the probe, then the rest of our analysis fell into place, and we could model the data and understand the vertical distribution and the size and the shape of the aerosols pretty well. So let's go to the next slide now. This shows the upward-looking visible spectrometer, that's ULVS, upward-looking visible spectrometer, the intensity that it measured divided by the flux from the sun as a function of altitude in many different wavelengths. And the points are the measurements, and the jaggedy lines are a model. And the lines are a little jagged because the probe was tipping and tilting, and as it tipped and tilted, the sun landed on a different part of our diffuser where it has a different transmission, and so that the jags go up and down. But the data has those jags, and actually the models have the same jags because we computed the models for the same orientation as we had. And so this is actually a pretty good fit. The fits are good to better than 10% at all the wavelengths in the continuum, that is where there's no methane absorption, and at all altitudes. So we're quite happy with this fit. The next slide shows the fit looking away from the sun. So these are azimuths of 180 degrees, plus or minus 30 or 40 degrees. And you can see the data are represented by points, and the models are represented by these solid lines that reproduce most of the jagged features, which are due to tips and tilts of the platform. So not only do you have to know roughly the azimuth to which you're pointing, but you also have to know the tip toward the sun and the tip perpendicular to the sun in order to model the data and analyze the data. And that all made the data analysis rather more difficult, but finally we're at the stage where we think we have a very good model. In addition to looking up toward the sun and away from the sun, we could look down, and the next slide shows the downward-looking visible spectrometer, the intensity divided by the flux from the sun, plotted against altitude for all the continuum wavelengths. And if you can look both up and down, then you can measure the amount of energy absorbed in these layers, and you can get the amount of energy absorbed in that slab. And so we thought that was important to do as well, and we did that on this experiment. And then finally, the next slide shows the spectrum, downward-looking visible spectra, at many different altitudes according to that key on the top of the slide. And you can see that the agreement between the points and the curves is really pretty good. And these features are due to methane absorption in the atmosphere, or gaseous absorption features, whereas the wavelengths that I've shown before have just been at the peaks of the spectra, that is, where there's no gaseous absorption, where it's just due to the aerosols themselves. So that's the downward-looking spectra, and the next slide shows the upward-looking spectra, and this is on a linear scale, and the top one shows the more or less continuous spectrum without much methane absorption, looking up toward the sun when you're at high altitude, and then as you gradually fall deeper and deeper in the atmosphere, the methane features get stronger and stronger, and we can actually reproduce them with a model, and then understand the distribution of methane and the absorption through the methane, as well as the continuum properties of the aerosol. The next slide shows the downward and upward looking spectra in the infrared at continuum locations. And let's just move ahead to the next slide after that, which shows the upward and downward looking spectra in the infrared. Actually, this is the upward looking spectra in two halves. The measurements are the points, and you can see the error bars on the logarithmic scale get big when you get to very, very dark levels. And the next slide after that shows the downward-looking spectra, again in two panels, the short half of the spectrum and then the long half of the spectrum. So now we have a model that fits in the continuum looking up and looking down, in the methane bands looking up and looking down, and really allows us to understand what's going on with the aerosols. Okay, so the next slide after that shows the optical depth of the aerosols as a function of wavelength, where the aerosols are broken into three vertical regions, above 80 kilometers, between 30 and 80 kilometers, and under 30 kilometers. And the optical depth is kind of, if the optical depth is 1, then you have about a 30% chance of a photon getting through that layer without hitting an aerosol particle. If the optical depth is 2, then you have about a 10% chance of a photon getting through. If the optical depth is 3, then you have maybe a 3% chance of a photon getting through without hitting an aerosol particle. But it's interesting how these curves vary with wavelength. The red curve at the highest altitudes varies most steeply with wavelength, and the steep variation with wavelength is an indication of a small aerosol particle. And then in the next layer from 30 to 80, the curve is less steep, indicating slightly larger particles, and in the lowest region under 30 kilometers, the curve is the least steep, and that's an indication of the largest particles yet. So let's move to the next curve. Okay, and this curve shows the brightness of the aerosol particles are actually what's called a single scattering albedo, which is the fraction of the energy that's reflected from a single bounce off an aerosol particle as a function of wavelength. And what we see is that at high altitudes, we have the red curve, where the particles are a little bit darker. At low altitudes, we have a higher curve, where the particles are a little bit brighter. And we think the particles are brighter at the lower altitudes because there's a little bit of condensate material that's been coating the particles, and so the light can't get into the particle and get absorbed. The absorption is strong in the blue end. In the red end, there's a peak in the curve, and then it drops off longward of about 800 nanometers or so. And that's actually the same shape as we see in the surface spectrum. So I think the drop-off in the surface and the drop-off in the aerosols is related, and I think the aerosols coat the surface and probably cause that drop-off in the surface. So it may be that the surface spectrum is not telling us so much about the ices that are there, the clean ices that are there, but they're telling us about the photochemical material in the aerosols, and I think that's something we're going to have to include in the modeling work in the future. Okay, and then the next slide shows the optical depth of the atmosphere as a function of altitude for all these different wavelengths. And what you can see is that the blue end at 400 nanometers and 350 nanometers, the atmosphere is very thick there, optically thick. There's no chance for a photon to get all the way through. But as you go to longer and longer infrared wavelengths, the optical depth gets less and less, and you have a better chance to get through. It's interesting to look at the curve for 934 nanometers, the green long dot dashed curve, and that shows that the total thickness of the atmosphere at 934 nanometers, which is the wavelength of the imaging camera on Cassini, the total optical depth of the atmosphere is about 3. So the chance of a photon getting through that atmosphere 3 with 3 optical depths is only about 3%. So about 3% of the light that the camera is looking at comes right from the point on the ground that's in a straight line with the camera, and the rest of the light, 97% of the light, has undergone at least one scattering and has come from some distance away, and that acts to blur the view. And so that's the reason that it's so difficult to see ground clearly from even from the Cassini optical camera in orbit, which is fairly close, would have really very high spatial resolution. But three optical depths of haze makes it difficult to see the ground very clearly from orbit. The next slide shows the number density of aerosols as a function of altitude. And above 80 kilometers, we see a red and a blue curve that go together, and it goes to a peak of about 5 particles per cubic centimeter. And that calculation was done for the shape particles that I showed when I showed the picture of the shape of the particles, and that all worked just fine. But below 80 kilometers, we think that the particles are somewhat coated with condensate material. That makes them shinier, and it also makes them scatter a little differently than the exact shape of that particle that I showed you. So the red and the blue curves diverge. If you use light from the red end of the spectrometer or from the blue end of the spectrometer, you conclude a slightly different number density. Well, there's only one real number density, but the particles are a complicated shape with a little coating of liquid on them, so they're very difficult to make exact calculations for. In the lower 30 kilometers of altitude, we think the particles are still larger, and if they look like different sizes, they would get different number densities. If they were sort of 3-micron spherical clumps of stuff, then you'd have several tenths of a particle per cubic centimeter. If they were 10-micron clumps, then you'd get several hundredths of a particle per cubic centimeter. So there's a family of solutions there between the size and the number density. But we know the opacity, and we know how they obscure the light. Okay, so that really concludes what we've learned about the aerosols. We know their vertical distribution, we know their size, we know their shape, we know their number density, we know something about their optical properties and their scattering properties. Another part of the experiment was to learn about the gases in the atmosphere, particularly methane. The methane in the atmosphere is at very cold temperatures, and it's for very long paths. There's an awful lot of methane molecules along the path. And that's a situation that's very difficult to simulate in a laboratory on the Earth. You can make a methane cell several hundred meters long. You can have many bounces, so you have a very long path, you know, half a kilometer or a kilometer long. But it's difficult to cool such a cell isothermally enough so that all the bounces survive. And so what you really have in the lab is a small cell that's cool at the cold temperature, or you have a large cell that's at warm temperatures, and it's very hard to measure the properties of methane under the right path lengths and at the right temperatures. And we thought that one thing we could do with our data is, since we know how methane bands form in Titan's atmosphere, that's exactly the case we're interested in. That's the long paths and the cold temperatures. So we should be able to figure out an improved methane absorption coefficient for these cases, which would be useful then for studying other planets in our solar system. So this slide shows the upward working spectrum as points on the left panel, and the model for how the methane would absorb as solid curves. And this is from some laboratory measurements that were extrapolated to Titan conditions. And what we see is that they're not a particularly good fit. They're not a good fit in the near continuum weak regions, and they're not a good fit in the strong regions either. But on the right panel, you can see the methane absorption coefficients that we've derived from the Visser measurements in Titan's atmosphere, and they can make very good fits. And so we've published this, and we hope that it'll be useful for modeling methane in the atmosphere of the other outer planets. The next slide shows that in the visible as well. And there's one band in the visible, in the near-infrared and in the visible, where, again, the dashed curves are the old standard numbers, and the solid curves and the points are the revised numbers that we got from the Visser data. So there's been significant improvement in getting the methane absorption coefficients. The next slide shows the spectrum of the ground when the ground was illuminated with our lamp from an altitude of 25 meters. And it's compared with different methane mixing ratios near the surface. Now, at 25 meters, now I've just been talking about how we don't have good laboratory measurements of methane. Well, we don't have good laboratory measurements of methane where the pressures are appropriate to the stratosphere, where the pressures are some millibars. It's difficult to get, with low pressures, a lot of methane in the cell. But you can increase the pressure to a bar or 5 bars or something like that and measure the methane absorption characteristics. And if you're at only 25 meters altitude on Titan, the pressure there is 1.5 bars, And there the data are in good agreement with the laboratory measurement. And so now all you have to do is vary the methane mixing ratio and see how much methane you have. And the points are the different measurements. The curves are for different methane mixing ratios of 4.7, 5.1, and 5.5 percent methane. And what we derived is shown at the bottom of that slide. We get 5.1 plus or minus a little less than 1% methane mixing ratio near the surface. And that's in very good agreement with the direct measurements made by the gas chromatograph and the mass spectrometer on the Huygens probe. So we think these optical measurements are in good agreement with the actual measurements at low levels, and we then trust the direct measurements throughout the atmosphere, so we know the amount of methane in the atmosphere, and then we get the methane absorption coefficients from the DISR data. And finally, in addition to methane, there's one more thing that we can do with these kinds of data, and that is if we now have a model of the aerosols on Titan, we know how they're vertically distributed, we can calculate how they absorb energy, and we can get the solar heating. And we can get the heat balance of the planet, and we can compare the solar heating with the thermal infrared cooling and get the net radiative forcing, which is what drives the winds and the dynamics in Titan's atmosphere. And so this first slide shows the energy deposition rate in watts per cubic meter per micron of wavelength at different altitudes, and you can see that at high altitudes, the red curve, it's mostly due to the aerosols. But when you get down to the lower altitudes, 15 kilometers, it's mostly due to the methane bands. And we know the mix of how much is due to methane, how much is due to aerosols, and how much occurs at all these different wavelengths, so we can calculate the total heating rate. And the next slide shows the heating rate averaged over the disk compared with the cooling rate measured by the infrared spectrometer on the Cassini orbiter. And averaged over the disk, the heating rates and the cooling rates are in pretty good agreement, we can see on this next slide. On the slide after that, we show the heating rate and the cooling rates at the latitude of the Huygens entry. And there the solar heating rate is in degrees Kelvin per 24-hour day, and the thermal cooling rate is in degrees K per 24-hour day. And you can see that the heating exceeds the cooling, and so the atmosphere would be warming up, and the gas would be expanding, and then it's driven to flow to another region, and that's the forcing for the wind field. So we've done that at the landing site, and the next curve actually shows the net heating minus cooling, and you can see that it's of the order of 1 degree Kelvin per Titan day. Of the order of a degree Kelvin per Titan day, and we have it the profile as a function of altitude. And then if you have that, then you can calculate the net radiative heating and cooling at all altitudes and at different parts of the disk for different latitudes, and so I have two slides that show that, but let's just skip through those sort of quickly, because actually those slides need to be recalculated, including the right aerosol distribution at the different parts of the planet, which we're now getting from the Cassini orbiter. So those have to be redone. But the last slide shows a summary of results from our DISR experiment. The first point is that the images of the surface show evidence of rain and fluid flow. Rain had been speculated before, but to actually see the river channels and the drainage basins is really very reassuring and really a good feeling. We made measurements of the height of the terrain because we have stereographic baselines. We can look at the same terrain from different points of view. We have measurements of the reflection spectrum of the surface, which eventually will tell us about the composition of the surface, although that's a work still in progress. We made measurements of the zonal and meridional winds, and that complements the Doppler wind experiment, which measured the zonal winds and the double baseline interferometry, which made good measurements at high altitudes. We have measurements of the size, optical properties, and vertical distribution of the haze aerosols for understanding their production and life cycles. We have measurements of methane absorption coefficients for long paths at low temperatures, which are really useful for analyzing the atmospheres of the other planets. We have measurements of the methane mixing ratio near the surface, which confirm the measurements made by the gas chromatograph. And finally, we've computed the solar heating rate and the thermal cooling rates and compared them at the landing site for studies of the heat balance of the Titan atmosphere and the drives for the wind field. So that's a summary of the DISR results. It was quite an ambitious experiment with cameras and spectrometers and sun sensors and data compressors and so on, but I think it was actually highly successful. It did pretty much everything we had in mind for the experiment to do, and in addition, returned the nifty movie that you have a chance to download and look at in your leisure. So that concludes what I was planning to say. And if there are any questions anybody cares to ask at this point, I'm happy to try to answer them. Or otherwise, you can go download your movie and take a look at the movie.
So do we have any questions?
Well, it was pretty technical. I understand it was a pretty technical talk, but I was told it was a really technically savvy audience.
It was challenging, but very, very interesting, Marty. I guess I have sort of a question. What do you think? I mean, this really was a very ambitious experiment, and as you say, just remarkably successful. What do you think is the sort of the big question that you have about either Titan surface or atmosphere? You know, coming sort of out of the Huygens probe mission. What do you think sort of is the big question?
Well, I think there are a couple of questions that remain that are really quite important and quite interesting to understand. One is, we see now that it rains. One question is, how often does it rain? And where does it rain? We know there are lakes at high latitudes, but we don't see actual rain falling in the DISR site. So where does it rain and how often does it rain is an important question. The other thing is, how does the methane actually get out of the surface and get back up into the atmosphere? It can't just get from those small lakes at high latitudes. I think there has to be another mechanism for getting the methane out of the interior. And finally, what's the composition actually of the surface, and what's the composition of the aerosols exactly? People have made laboratory experiments and tried to simulate the aerosols, but we'd like to really fit that reflection spectrum of the surface in greater detail to understand the composition a little better. So those are three kinds of questions that are important. And finally, we know what the terrain looks like around the probe landing site, but you know, what we've seen from the radar images and from the images of the camera on Cassini, the terrain varies an awful lot on Titan. You have places where you have sand dunes, you have places where you have river channels, you have lakes, you have drainage basins. How does all of this evidence of active geology, how does that all work together? And how is the surface formed, and what are the surface processes that are still ongoing and still forming the surface? So that's another set of questions that deserving of a little more study, I think.
Those are some big questions.
Yeah. So
we definitely need another mission to Titan.
Well, that would be really great. It would be really great. Can you imagine sending one probe to the Earth and having it land either in the Pacific Ocean or in a desert or in a rainforest? And you might draw very different conclusions about what the Earth was like if you only had a single probe. So maybe we could use a few more probes, or maybe something on a balloon that would be blown around by the winds and get close-up looks at other places, or maybe a higher resolution radar. Or, you know, there are a lot of things you could imagine for another mission to Titan that would be really important and really interesting.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that one of the data channels was non-functional during the descent, did that impact your experiments at all?
It did impact us. It was recommended that we put the same data on both channels. And actually, all of our spectral data was put on both channels, and we got all of that spectral data. But as far as the images go, we could have put 350 images on the first channel, and the same 350 images on the second channel. But we really thought that was not maybe the best thing to do. We thought, well, if one channel fails, we'll still have 350 images. If they both work, we'll have the same 350 twice. You know, what good is that? So we put different images on the two channels. We put 350 on the first and a different 350 on the second. And because we lost the second, we still got the same number of images, but we didn't have as much overlap, and we couldn't do the three-dimensional terrain height analysis of as many places in the scene as we would have been able to if we had had both channels working. So that was the biggest impact for us. We got pretty good spatial coverage, but we didn't get the double coverage that we would have needed if we'd really wanted to do or tried to do stereographic analysis from different pieces of terrain. So we got a few places where we could do the 3D stereographic analysis, but not as much coverage of the 3D stuff as we would have wanted. That was the biggest impact.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have any other questions? Okay, well, with that, we will thank Marty for joining us today. We really appreciate it. It was really a terrific talk, Marty, and we appreciate you taking your time.
You might mention where that website is, or maybe they have it in their information about where the movie is.
In fact, I will mention that again. There is a video that goes with this presentation, and it's on the password-protected site, and everyone should take a look at the original email that they received. The information for logging into the password-protected site is on there, and if you have any trouble, you can contact the charm_leads_01@cdsa.jpl.nasa.gov, and we will have a very interesting topic next month. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure that Dr. Amanda Hendricks has planned something spectacular. And with that, we'll let everybody go, and we will see you next month.
Great. Thanks very much, Trina.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.